back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
The subject of discussion, the Cash Landrum case in Texas in December of 1980. And two questions on the table from Chris O'Brien of our guests, Chris Lambright and Kurt Collins. Number one, of course, other witnesses other than the basic three. And two, a strange comment from the examining doctor.
Well, first of all, I want to say that I've blown the tone of the story chronologically so bad, and I hope anyone that has any interest in UFOs at all will do some reading on this case, because it's a, you know, there's so many things that we're going to skip over and just can't cover in detail. But as far as the doctor, that's a very interesting part, because that was a cardiologist, Dr. V.B. Chenoy. When he hears about the UFO, he discusses with his other colleagues, and there's a Dr. Howard Sussman. He happens to be a UFO researcher himself. He's a member of APRA and probably some of the other UFO organizations. He's familiar with the lore. He knows that there have been stories of UFO burns apparently producing radiation and causing similar problems. So he gives the doctors some ideas that this could be the cause, and he also talks to a friend and colleague of his in the Houston area, John F. Schuessler. That's when John Schuessler, who was an engineer for McDonnell Douglas, a contractor working at NASA's Johnson Space Center. So this is he's a deputy director of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, which was you mentioned we were talking about APRO earlier. APRO apparently had a separation of ranks, and there was a disagreement over policy.
And that's the way the UFO field is, by the way. These organizations have policy disagreements, and they split apart, and they create new organizations.
That was MUFON. So John Schuessler was very active in that, and he, at some point, he receives word separately from APRO about this case, because they're unable, due to the distance involved, to track the case down. He lives in Houston, which is just a short distance away from things happen. This is in his backyard, so he begins investigating the case. We're going to come back to that now. What was our other question? I forgot. It was about the
other witnesses.
Well, additional witnesses. Did Gribble get any reports at the National UFO Center, MUFON, APRO? Anybody else see this? Because a sighting of this magnitude, such a low-level sighting of such a large object shooting out flames, accompanied by possibly several squadrons of helicopters, you would think that you would generate more than just the primary witness reports.
That's right. In that Weekly World News story, there were three witnesses who were quoted and then seemed to disappear from the UFO record. It was Nellie Zedek, her son John, and his wife Tony. They saw a diamond-shaped bright object, but no helicopters. And unfortunately, there's no other detailed report on them, and as far as I know, nothing else. After the story broke, there were pleas in the media for additional witnesses. And that's troublesome to me, because that almost seems like they're saying, you know, please help the victims of this accident. Won't you come forward? They were recruiting, you could say, witnesses. And they did receive a response, but this signing occurred close to the international airport there in Houston, about 15 miles away from it. And if this, you would think things could be seen from there, but apparently there's no record of radar seeing the event or the helicopters. But you know, three counties there that potentially to draw from, and no one independently reported it. But afterwards, there was a policeman who said that he saw something later the same night, but he saw only helicopters, and you know, 9 to 12 maybe. He described similar models, and they were searching the fields for something. Other people said that they saw them, but there was there was not an exact match for the UFO. One report said that he saw a UFO the size of a football field. I think it was rectangular, and he saw aliens inside with Roman noses. And it seemed so fantastic and so unlike what they had reported. You just have to wonder if that was more origin of fantasy. But there was one good one, though. But again, it was a different UFO. It was a triangular-shaped object. This was a Jerry McDonald. He saw the UFO about, I think his was maybe closer to 8 in the evening, and their sighting was at 9. And he saw it flying over the city of Dayton. He saw a triangular UFO with several lights on it. And when he first looked up, he thought it was the Goodyear blimp, which Houston did have a Goodyear blimp flying at the time, but not that night. And so there were some UFO reports. There were some helicopter reports, but no one saw helicopters and UFOs.
Chris Lambright, you want to expand on that before we go on?
Well, he's absolutely correct. I mean, that's the good thing about someone like Kurt, who's been really focusing on this for the last 2 years, is he's fresh on many of the details, if not most of them. What he described about the police officer who said he saw the helicopters and the other witnesses, in particular the triangular shape, is absolutely correct. But even Vicky made clear that they didn't have anybody who saw the helicopters and the UFOs themselves. The only aspect of the triangular part of it that I'm on the fence about, as far as potentially being correct, is because one of the things that I realized in doing the illustration I did was, depending on how dark it was that night, and if there was, let's say, the flame was coming out of only one end and reflecting just off of one end of a diamond-shaped object, you might, depending on the distance, really only notice that end, which would potentially leave it looking kind of triangular. The other side would basically be pitch black. You wouldn't even see it. I mean, that's hypothetical or a conjecture, but no, Kurt's doing a bang-up job of the details.
I was going to say, at this point in the story, the UFO investigation really began. John Schussler led a team called Project Visit, and it was usually mostly his colleagues there at the Johnson Space Center. I mean, these were engineers. These were guys that should be building UFOs and spacecraft. You know, they were. He was, and most of them were involved in the space shuttle program, which, by the way, you know, remember, this is 1980. It was just right during that same time that the space shuttle first launched. So there were a lot of space developments. So these guys were probably pretty busy in their day jobs, which is kind of interesting. But so on their evenings and weekends, they were looking into this case. John Schussler met Betty Cash. He saw her injuries. He took photographs of her hair loss. She told him the story. And he, when he first talked to her on the phone, you know, he was concerned, you know, because he didn't put two and two together. This was the woman that his friend, Dr. Sussman, had talked about. But, you know, eventually he makes a connection. She's still weak from her problems, medical problems. And he examines the car with a Geiger counter and apparently doesn't show anything. I think he's got a compass and it doesn't show magnetic effects. But one strange thing was, and one of the many details that were overlooked, was that when exactly when this happened during the sighting, we're not sure, but Vicky Landrum reached forward and the heat had caused the dashboard to be so soft, her the fingerprints, or not fingerprints, but the impression of her fingers were molded into the dashboard. And this, the remember, this is Houston. The summer's getting very hot there. Cars are built to withstand this normal heat. So this is one strange thing, whether it's an anomaly, can't say. But that was one detail of the case. The ladies in particular, it impressed them because that was a lasting, visible reminder of the encounter.
This is the Cash Landrum encounter. We're talking about it on our show this week with Kurt Collins and Chris Lambright. With Gene and Chris, you're in
the Paracast.
Attack of the Rockoids has been well received by critics and readers alike. It's a thrill-a-minute story you'll never forget.
a former U.S. military intelligence officer, is haunted by intense dreams about a beautiful woman pleading for his help after a terrible battle in outer space. But the dreams turn out to be true and thrust him into a telepathic love affair with a woman whose faraway planet is intent on destroying the Earth. And now the gripping tale continues in The Coming of the Protectors. It's the second book of the Rockoids trilogy, a galaxy-spanning adventure that pits our hapless heroes against powerful, fanatical enemies that threaten the lives of freedom-loving beings everywhere. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors, classic science fiction at its best, available now. For more details, visit Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids.com.
Gold. If you listen to the radio, watch TV, or surf the net, you're hearing about gold. Eventually you will ask yourself, is gold right for me? The answer might surprise you. We protect ourselves and our families from many things. Do you have medical insurance? Is your home insured? Do you carry life insurance? How about financial insurance? If you own gold, then the answer is yes. If you don't own gold, the question is, why don't you have financial insurance? We put our faith in things we trust. Do you trust the dollar? Do you trust the economy? Do you trust the government? Gold has always been something you can trust. For thousands of years, people have put their faith in gold. Where will you put your faith? Now is the time to protect yourself and your family. Call Midas Resources today at 1-800-686-2237, extension 242. 1-800-686-2237, extension 242. And ask for Jim Parker. Let me help you get started today. 1-800-686-2237, extension 242.
If you owe the IRS back taxes, listen carefully. Sweeping changes to IRS policies will help more people than ever eliminate their tax debts once and for all. And now, I can help you reduce or eliminate your tax debts and end your tax nightmare. Hi, I'm Dan Pilla. I've helped thousands of people reduce and eliminate tax debts they couldn't pay, and after more than 30 years of experience dealing with the IRS, I can tell you there's no such thing as a hopeless tax case. And with the IRS's new policies, it's easier than ever to put your tax debt behind you once and for all. Call now at 800-346-6829 to learn how I can help you. You know your IRS debt will not go away by itself, but you don't have to live in fear anymore. Call 800-346-6829. Learn how I can help you eliminate wage and bank levies, release tax liens, and negotiate a settlement with the IRS that will put your tax nightmare behind you forever. Call 800-34-NO-TAX or go to TaxHelpOnline.com. That's TaxHelpOnline.com.
Digestive health is the key to wellness and elimination of toxins. That bears repeating. Digestive health is the key to wellness and elimination of toxins. And Pro-EM-1 Daily Probiotic Cleanse is the key to digestive health. Pro-EM-1 is a powerful liquid probiotic, strong enough to cleanse, gentle enough to use every day. Pro-EM-1 is dairy, wheat, and soy free. Contains all natural and certified organic ingredients. Contains no preservatives or animal products. Supports a healthy digestive and immune system. Supports weight loss. Improves absorption of food nutrients, aids in controlling yeast infections, is never freeze-dried, and uses three groups of live, viable, beneficial microbes to cleanse and remove toxins. Order Pro-EM-1 Daily Probiotic Cleanse at Terraganics.com, spelled TerraganiX.com, Terraganics.com, or call toll-free 866-369-3678. That's 866-369-3678. Pro-EM-1, the raw probiotic.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
Our guests are Chris Lambright and Kurt Collins, both of whom have done extensive investigations into the Cash Landrum case. So, you know, I'm thinking of the scene of embedding handprints or anything into a car. It's almost like the scene in Man of Steel, the new Superman reboot, where the kids in school are taunting Clark Kent, who's afraid to fight back because he's Superman. He's the young Superman. And he puts his hand on this fence, this metal fence, and you can see where he's just embedded it because of his strength.
I don't know if the impression was that strong, but, you know, nevertheless, it was still there years later. And Betty Cash owned that car for years. And getting back to the car, that's neither of these ladies were wealthy. So she couldn't afford to say, hey, here, take my car and examine it. She had to drive it. So that's one of the bad things, is that maybe the examination of the car, if it were treated as evidence, that it would yield it something.
Nobody took a Geiger counter to that car to see what's going on.
Yeah, John Schuster did.
But that was the extent of it. There were no further tests that we know of. I think there was, I have read that there was a piece of plastic on the dashboard that he examined, but apparently nothing was found because nothing was ever published about that.
So basically, the car itself, there were no, at least on the surface, symptoms of anything really weird other than this.
Some, but not extraordinary. Betty claimed that the car ran roughly after the encounter. Another thing, another effect is, and then this is one of the things that we don't know if this is from bad reporting or just how this happened, but the initial report was written, they said that Betty turned the ignition off of the car. Well, when she, I don't know if she actually said that or if that was assumed and that was written that way. And when she talked to another UFO investigator, Alan Hendry, who was at the Center for UFO Studies, she specifically said that she had not turned the car off and that it had stalled when the UFO was present. And if you remember the scene in Close Encounters where the UFO stops the car, that's based on other UFO cases, and you know that's been reported before.
So, another element that has always puzzled me was brought out by the television show Sightings, I believe, or Unsolved Mysteries years ago when they covered this particular case. That, what, about 100-foot stretch of road was fairly shortly thereafter repaved, correct? It was torn up and repaved. Was that a detail I'm remembering correctly?
Chris spoke directly with Vicki Landrum about this, and I'd like for him to describe what she told him.
Great. Yes, in fact, it's kind of back in my memory because I was watching a little of her videotape talking about this last night, that apparently shortly thereafter she got some calls from people who lived in that area. And to kind of refresh the whole story, at the time, this was a narrow little blacktop road. I mean, nothing fancy, just a little, you could barely get two cars to go past on this perfectly straight stretch of road between very, very tall pine trees. And she's reiterated, there were a couple of trailers maybe, you know, up and down that stretch, nothing right there, but basically there were no houses or anything. It was a fairly deserted stretch. And shortly after the incident, she's got calls from people who said they're tearing up the road. And she said, someone came out, and I think she said it was within a week or a matter of days, came out, chopped up that section of the road, hauled it off in covered trucks, and laid the, you know, re-poured the asphalt. She then said, apparently, that bit of asphalt turned mushy, I think was the term she used, and they came back, cut it up again, and redid it, and I believe it was at this time that she says they laid about a 100-foot stretch of concrete, because she said for a while you could tell, you drive down the road and all of a sudden turn white for that stretch right where this event occurred, according to her. And she said there were, for years, she could go right by there and know exactly where, you know, where the event occurred. Then ultimately, at about the time that there was a small store that started up, so that was kind of a landmark that she used to kind of remember about where the event occurred. About that time, they came back and apparently then just re-blacktopped the entire stretch. So apparently the concrete was not obvious any longer. Apparently right after, within a matter of days or a week or so after the event, somebody came in trucks, covered trucks, chopped up that part of the road, hauled it off, and subsequently went back, hauled off what they had done, redid it again, and poured concrete over that stretch, and then a third time, blacktopped the whole thing. So by the time I was down there in 1985, it was a very nice, smooth, well-done road, nice white lines on both sides, you know, the whole nine yards. But yes, it was very clear to her, and one of the points she made very obvious, that somebody came in pretty quickly after the event and cut up that part of the road where the event occurred.
Chris, were you able to get any information about highway department projects as to why they might have done this thing, some kind of official explanation?
I wasn't, but it's funny you mention that. I had a young man who was a friend at the time who right in the time period of 85 when I was interested in this. And for some reason, just on his own, one day he told me he had started calling around to see if he could find out who had done this. Apparently, there were no real records on who did it. But he told me he talked to somebody who used the word boron. I don't know whether that's a normal something that's mixed in with highway or concrete or whatnot, but that there was some boron in a part of the road that was put there. And I'll mention this, even though I do want to qualify it by saying this is, I guess you would say, hearsay, something that I even had stumbled across on, I don't know if it was UFO Updates or one of the above top secret sites, where someone had written in his own, he said, I just want to give you my own testimony. You can find it if you look for it, and I don't know any more than that, but it, when I read it, my gut instinct was, it sounds extremely believable. A gentleman who said he and a friend of his were driving down that road one night, and it wasn't until later on when he read about the incident of the women's experience that it dawned on him that this would have been about that time. He was driving down that stretch of road one night, and suddenly the whole road was blocked with sawhorses both ways. He said at first they thought it would have been an accident, but it was unusual on that road to block both directions. And he said there was a crew out there with a backhoe digging up the road. They could smell the smell of creosote asphalt, and they just had a light in the trees. Nothing, the men working were not marked in, you know, anything like road course. Who would be doing road construction in the middle of the night? That was the point. It was in the middle of the night, and they had both directions, both lanes blocked, and they had to turn around and go back the other direction. But apparently he remembered that after reading about the Cash Landrum case as something that he thought was very unusual. Why in the middle of the night? Why would construction crew that? But he was just giving his own testimony. So if he was available to be for anybody to talk to him, if someone could find out who he was, it would be really interesting to know if he could, and his friend would both verify that.
I have another question here real quick. John Schussler, you know, was a top scientist, and you know, I've known John for many years. He's retired now. But I'm wondering if he made any effort to go out and actually do radiation readings at the site and possibly test some of the trees that were obviously, if you're going to be, you know, heating up an environment, you're going to have some sort of effect shown in the foliage of the trees and grasses and that sort of thing. Do you know of anybody that did any sort of field site investigation of the Cash Landrum case?
We'll have that answer in our next segment with Chris Lambright and Kurt Collins joining Gene and Chris. You're in
the Paracast.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Graphic Converter is the image manipulation tool for the rest of us. It does not use any database. You get full control of all your files. Want to view the images of a folder? Drag it into Graphic Converter and a powerful browser opens up to show your image files. You could use it for slideshows. You could use it to import images from digital cameras or from scanners. Need to do some image editing? You can do that too in Graphic Converter. Also print catalogs. Convert from so many formats, I can't even list them. Download now to see if Graphic Converter is good for you, like 1.5 million other users. Guess what? You could save money when you buy Graphic Converter. Use the coupon code Night Owl. Use the coupon code Night Owl to get a special price for Graphic Converter. Go to LemkeSoft.com. That's LemkeSoft.com. LemkeSoft.com. LemkeSoft.com.
What's safer and cheaper than prescription drugs?
Glad you asked. The answer is Renovation Teas. Herbal remedies are much safer and much cheaper than prescription drugs. Taste great, and most importantly, herbal teas are effective and non-addictive. Renovation Tea is especially unique, and here's why. We spent years researching herbs and their beneficial properties. Renovation Teas uses only 100% organic, fair trade herbs. Our teas are blended towards specific ailments and health conditions, such as diabetes, blood pressure, anxiety, libido, detox, and much more. All Renovation Teas are formulated and hand-filled in Arkansas. Take care of yourself naturally, the way Mother Nature intended. Order Renovation Teas at renovationtea.com or call 870-784-3121. That's 870-784-3121. Renovation Teas. Renovate your health, one bag at a time.
Big business has discovered the preparedness market, and that makes it difficult to know where to go and who to trust. MyPatriotSupply.com is owned and operated by patriots just like you, has the best prices on storable food, non-GMO seeds, water filtration devices, home canning equipment, survival and self-reliance books, and more. MyPatriotSupply.com has old-fashioned values and the absolute best customer service in the industry. Look for the deal of the day, unique, affordable survival supplies that fit anyone's budget. Get same-day shipping on all orders and free shipping on orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927, 866-229-0927, or visit MyPatriotSupply.com for emergency preparedness, self-reliance, and food independence. Shop with a name you know and a name you can trust. Before it's time to survive, it's time to prepare. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Utopiasilver.com believes, as the Declaration of Independence states, that our rights come from God, not from government. The only lawful purpose of any government is to protect and secure the rights of the people, and no man or government has the authority to take what has been given to us by God. Among these rights are life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. And America's government has ceased to be the protector of liberty and of the people's God-given rights. But we the people can return America to greatness if we are willing to stand up and reassert our stolen rights. We ask that you join Utopia Silver in changing America's course in history. To save on healthcare and improve your health, call Utopia Silver at 888-213-4338. For a limited time, new customers will receive 50% off all colloidal silver and colloidal gold supplements. Visit us today at utopiasilver.com. That's U-T-O-P-I-A Silver, utopiasilver.com. Or call 888-213-4338. That's 888-213-4338.
This is Jacques Vallée, and you're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
With two Chris's, I remember the last time we had the situation, Mr. O'Brien, we gave you a different name. We'll call you Trickster today, okay? Is that okay?
I think we called me KK last time.
Right, KK.
My true Kim Keegan Barnes is the name I was born with, so you can call me KK. The
Trickster
thing will drive the forum posters nuts. I don't think they'll be able to handle it.
Okay, we have KK with Chris Lambright and Kurt Collins, and KK had asked a question just before our break, which we'll hear the answer to right now.
Well, we need to acknowledge the work that John Schuessler did in this case. Now, initially, he's investigating this with a team of his project visits, his squad, and these are all highly trained people. So they're interviewing the witnesses. They take Vicki Landrum to the scene, and they determined they found the location, measured the distance, and it took a Geiger counter, which apparently didn't find anything. So there was some initial testing of the scene. There are photographs. There are no close-up photographs of the road that I've been able to find, but there's a road sign, and then a team member, Alan Holt, is in the distance to indicate the position from the car to where the UFO was spotted. And they're the ones that helped get the word out to the media to get some coverage, to try to get some help for the attention for the witnesses and some help for them. And the helicopter and the UFO witnesses came forward as a result of this. One of the key things at this point was that through his network of contacts in MUFON, John Schuessler sent a copy of the medical records that were available to Dr. Peter Rank, who is a MUFON member, and he's a radiologist at, I think it was the University of Wisconsin. Without examining the witnesses, looking only at the photographs and medical records, it was his opinion that they were exposed to radiation. The available information from the doctors at Parkway Hospital listed the symptoms, and they couldn't say, okay, well, this is from, I'm just making something up, leukemia. There wasn't just one medical condition that caused it. The problem with the radiation was, if it was ionizing radiation, like from a nuclear weapon or, you know, shielding that was bad, to cause the symptoms, it should have instantly killed them or shortly thereafter. Some of the symptoms, like the Vicki Lanham had eye problems, but I think they all did to some extent as a result of the either the bright light or the radiation. That that was more characteristic of something else, and some of the characteristics reflected what would have been caused by microwave radiation. So there was no easy answer for what caused their problem. And it was almost as if you had to have some multi-radiation emitting source. So that was quite puzzling. And with the controversy that developed was, since those medical records weren't released, it couldn't be proved that there was a one-for-one correlation between the injuries and the UFO sighting.
I'll tell you something that I thought was really nicely coincidental, or at least unusual, is about 6 months before this event, in the May of 1980, MUFON Journal, was an article written by Richard Nimzow and John Schuster called Evaluation of Medical Injuries Resulting from UFO Close Encounters. And in the first paragraph, they almost cite line by line the exact symptoms that that these ladies experienced, starting with, nausea, vomiting, headache, blindness, perception of odors. Then they go into more chronic effects, skin lesions, pathology through unknown mechanisms, skin lesions which previously were described as burns produced by ionizing radiation do not compare clinically as we know it, on and on and on. A very short article, but I thought, wow, it was mighty timely that about 6 months later, or whenever he found out about it, that a case came up that exhibited almost exactly what they were citing.
I don't want to be too skeptical, but it's almost as if they were waiting for this to happen.
You know, I'm interested here in the other possibility that I raised earlier. I mean, it sounds like a pretty strange aircraft when you hear the description. But is there any possibility at all, and either of you can answer this or both of you separately, or together in unison, any possibility this was a test aircraft of some kind?
Yes.
Yes, but we're not going to go there directly. There's some things we have to say about the investigation. John Schuster took information from the witnesses, descriptions. Vicki was even hypnotized, and so all the details didn't come out at once. And one of the things Colby had done was he attempted to draw the scene. Now, he wasn't much of an artist, but he and there's parts of this I really need to let Chris tell. But he developed a picture of the UFO and a description. He said that the center of it was running with blue lights and that the craft was glowing. And now's the time in the story. And we're going to come back to the secret craft where Chris describes how he was attempting to do a painting, an accurate painting of the UFO.
Well, yeah, actually, at the time that, I don't know if any of you have seen this painting I did of the Socorro object, back in the day, I had hoped to do a number of them. This was when I was an investigator for the Center for UFO Studies, and I'd even talked to Dr. Hynek about this. But the point was getting the exact description so that I wasn't misleading anyone made this thing just, it was going to take too much time. But the third one that I had worked on was the Cash Landrum object, and when I went down to talk to Vicki, I actually brought my initial workup with me and showed it to her to just get an idea from her whether she thought it was about the right shape or whatnot. And one of the media things she mentioned was there were no blue lights around the middle of it, which threw me for a loop. And I asked her, I said, well, wait a minute. A lot of this information I've gotten from the articles and the illustrations that John has produced. And she didn't know where. I said, well, John's one of the articles that he's published, I think his wife or daughter had done an illustration of it and had these blue lights on it. And Vicki was the one who first mentioned, wait a minute, he must have got that from Colby's Light Bright board. And interestingly enough, I sent Kurt some information the other day, some excerpts from one of the conversations that Vicki had in which she described how all of this was worked out. And Colby had apparently been traumatized and had started going through those old Big Chief drawing pads, just drawing and drawing and drawing. And even Betty, I think, had mentioned that Vicki was spending a lot of money buying those notepads, and ultimately they just bought a little electronic light bright board. And somewhere along the way, it was apparently Colby who had just been putting in the little lights, making his own child's little illustration, apparently, according to the ladies, that had been what John kind of based his illustrations on to present this idea of this glowing object with what obviously definitely looked like something out of the movie Close Encounters, like these little blue lights around the middle, when in fact, as Vicky told me, if you know the thing was very, very dark, and if it hadn't been for the flames, they may have just driven right under it, not even seen it. So the illustrations that are accompanying the articles, and even if you go back to, his, I guess, in mid-1981, that soon after the event, this picture's already being presented of an object that's not at all what the act, other than the diamond shape and the flames, the object was not glowing from any information I've been able to find, and that Kurt can maybe tell you differently, but everything seems to be that the light, the flames, were the only real source of light. There was no other markings or any lights or anything on the object.
See, this is remarkable to me because there are two major characteristics of the UFO that are blown somehow by the chief investigator. So it's, I don't know if you remember in the Beltway Sniper case, someone said that they spotted a white van, and the whole concentration was chasing after this imaginary white van that had nothing whatsoever to do with the case. And in this instance, we're given this description of something that, with the blue lights, it sounds more like a spacecraft, and it's getting in the way of us finding what was actually there and what it might have been.
I'll tell you what, we got to find out what this is going to be in a moment. We have Chris Lambright and Kurt Collins with Gene and KK. You're in
the Paracast.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Whether it's personal mail, whether it's business email, you want reliable, dependable delivery, freedom from spam, freedom from viruses. Well, Polaris Mail offers professional email hosting services for your personal or small business use. Each account uses 25 gigabytes of storage, an easy-to-use webmail interface, and full mobile sync. Sign up today for a 30-day free trial at PolarisMail.com, PolarisMail.com. So here's what happened. I was placing an order online. The site went down. It just stopped responding. It took hours before it returned, but I'd already placed the order with another company. If your site goes down, you could lose business. And if you have a business or personal site, you'll want to know it's easy to run and it will stay online. At iWeb, your site is hosted on one of the most reliable networks in the world. Check it out. iWeb.com. That's iWeb.com.
Are you still a traditional smoker? Now experience a new lifestyle and try vaping with e-cigarettes by LeCig. Imagine no ashes, stains, nasty smell, or coughing and hacking. With LeCig e-cigarettes' revolutionary microelectronic technology, rechargeable battery, and unique replaceable cartridge, you'll get all the benefits and satisfaction of smoking without the hazards. Choose your taste from a wide variety of our new American-made Vaporeon e-liquids at LeCig.com. And LeCig smokes the competition by serving thousands of worldwide customers with real people customer service, fast, free, same-day shipping, and a 30-day warranty and satisfaction guarantee. So are you ready for a new vaping lifestyle? Then call 870-518-4307. That's 870-518-4307. Or visit LeCig.com, spelled LeCig.com. LeCig e-cigarettes for today's modern smoker.
To thank you for being a loyal listener, we have a limited time freebie offer for you. Claim your free heirloom tomato seeds, just pay shipping, right now at 123freeseeds.com. These aren't ordinary seeds. These are heirloom, non-genetically modified super seeds that are open-pollinated and can be grown, harvested, and replanted endlessly. These survival seeds are actually more valuable than gold in a crisis. Go to 123freeseeds.com and you can get an airtight storage packet of 150 super seeds free while supplies last to say thank you for being a loyal listener. First come, first served. Just cover shipping. Go to 123freeseeds.com now to see if your free heirloom seeds are still available. That's 123freeseeds.com.
Pharmacist Ben Fuchs believes virtually all disease states can be backtracked to digestive problems.
Deficiencies in stomach acid can affect all downstream systems. Taking digestive enzymes can be amazingly helpful for dealing with deficiencies in stomach acid. Enzymes require low pH for activation. You can also use aloe vera juice, by the way. Sugars in aloe vera have a coating effect on the digestive system. Longevity has a cool product called Noni Plus, which is made from aloe and the noni fruit. It's tasty. It can also function to support digestive acidification of the stomach, and activation of digestive enzymes.
Take pharmacist Ben's advice and support your digestive system by ordering Noni Plus from Longevity. Call 866-735-2470. That's 866-735-2470 or on the web at brightsideben.com. That's brightsideben.com. Order today.
Hello, this is John Burroughs, one of the witnesses to the Rendlesham UFO incident. You're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
We might officially call this the Paracast with Gene Steinberg and KK. Just make it permanent. Confuse everybody out there. Kurt Collins and Chris Lambright joining us. We're talking about the Cash Landrum case. Guys, a lot more to cover, so let's go for it.
Okay. We were talking about APRO earlier. Well, there was besides the animosity that already existed, APRO started questioning the methods and sources and the medical history. And whatever John Schuster was doing, this caused him to get into a distracting feud and possibly to guard that information more carefully. And when other people, like even a former member of his visit team, I'm having trouble pronouncing, the Dr. Nemesow that Chris mentioned earlier, he had joined the Air Force. He was denied access to the records, former partner. Phil Klass wanted the records, and it's understandable why he wasn't given access to that. But APRO was shut out, and several other people were. And it was Ambrose's position, getting back to Gene's question earlier, that it was a test of a secret aircraft. And apparently the version of that story may have originated or at least been circulated by the infamous Moore later.
Boy, he pops up in all the most curious places, doesn't he?
It was in the 80s, so, this runs smack through this.
If I can interject one thing just, and maybe this isn't some deference to whoever got the case first, I was looking through all of the old MUFON journals last night, and I have one sitting right in front of me here. The first article that I could find in the MUFON journal that mentions this case was the April of 1981, was an article by Richard Hall. Not John Schuster. John Schuster's, I think, came later in August or sometime. But even in this original little one-page kind of a synopsis where it talks about the radiant heat and radiant injury, he says, we're watching a luminous object hover low over the road ahead of their car. And it does indicate that by this time Schuster's investigating, but it says a luminous, fiery-looking object descended to treetop level and mentions the beeping and specifies then from its underside flames were emitted. But there's a tiny sketch with it that has a dotted line over the top saying glow. Does not have anything indicating lights across the middle, but it does seem to suggest that the object was glowing. But I was simply making the point that for whatever reason, Richard Hall seemed to have written the first short article outlining this case before even John's article about the injuries appeared a few months later.
You're absolutely right about that. There's a reason for that. I'll try not to make this too long of a history lesson, but Schuster reported, made a very quick, I think it was by March 2nd, he first met the witnesses. He met Betty Cash February the 2nd. The next week, met Vicki Landrum, investigated the scene, and then just a few days later, March 2nd, did his initial report, and Richard Hall summarized that. And then it was a long gap between the time where John Schuster himself published anything But he did appear that fall at a second Center for UFO Studies symposium, and he gave a presentation on the case then. And then it was after that, MUFON published an article, and I think it was reprinted in a UFO magazine also. So it could be, I don't think anyone was deliberately attempting to mislead. I think that there were some mistakes made in the haste in the investigation, and they were cemented, and it muddied the record. I mean, and it makes it much harder to get to the truth of what actually happened when it becomes, you know, part of the UFO legend.
Yeah, I think Kurt's opinion on that side of this is totally valid. I mean, it's regrettable that, and in one case, I think it's to his advantage and all of our advantage that now, all these years later, he's done so much digging with material that is now available on the internet. And he's able to see these changes as they occur and actually maybe get a better idea of the big picture of how it happened.
Well, that leads us to a question by one of our forum posters, Joey22, who doesn't post very often, but he posted a question, several questions for you guys. Do either of you know of any sightings since the Cash Landrum case in 1980 that the descriptions resemble the craft that Cash and Landrum saw?
I've got one. Chris, how about you?
Nothing exact. I mean, as far as just a dark object with flames coming out of it, the flames are kind of atypical, but if you've got a good one, go for it.
This is strange, partly because of the location. This was in Liberty County. It was, I believe this was 1983, so this was, you know, just barely 2 years later, I'm not sure if he was a deputy sheriff or deputy policeman, he was investigating a car theft ring. He saw a diamond-shaped craft that had some red lights on it. He said it was big enough the size-wise that, you know, if you do the outline, you could park about 10 cars in it. And it had something that looked like bright headlights. There were no flames, but it was diamond shaped and it was close to the area. So that may mean nothing whatsoever, but you know, it's got to be interesting.
It's funny you mentioned that talking about other cases in the area, and I should send you these because I did find in my files a couple of reports by other people in the area, and I believe, Vicky probably gave me their addresses and put me onto them, but I will send those to you. But there are people who cited unusual things, and maybe in one case it was roughly diamond-shaped, so to speak. But you're right, not at the same time and nothing that's a spot-on match for what they described.
Well, as far as just to get back to something similar, one of the things that we didn't mention was that their impression, I said that they didn't imagine a relationship or behavior. There was one behavior that they described, impression. They thought that the craft was in distress. They thought it was having trouble flying. So that was one thing. So it's possible that those flames were not part of the intended performance of the craft, that it was some sort of, it might have been venting flame or fluid, something like that.
Yeah, I would agree with that, actually. I mean, I'd say, in my opinion, that's far more of a likelihood.
Yeah, and I seem to remember from reading early reports on the case that the women did have a sense that the craft was in trouble and that the bobbing up and down was inadvertent, at least in their impression, and that the later sighting of helicopters may have somehow been related to some sort of problem that the craft was having.
Yeah, Vicky makes the point in the interview that I did with her of stating that this thing sounded like a motor that was in trouble. And that's kind of what I was getting at earlier when I said my feeling that if these helicopters, wherever they came from, had come from somewhere like Fort Hood, they had to be in the air already to arrive right when these ladies had seen it. So maybe that adds up to indicating that there was some problem that was already known to be occurring.
But then, based on what you're saying there, and we'll get amplification as we go along, this indicates more and more that we knew what it was and that it was conventional.
Well, I mean,
I don't think anyone. Go ahead.
That's never really been conclusively demonstrated. But here's another question from Joey22. Have there been any recent attempts to learn more about the government's possible involvement in the case through any sort of FOIA requests? How have the FOIA requests, how has that gone over the years with this case?
I did a number of them back in the day, but unfortunately my experience and my feelings about FOIA these days are you're not going to get anything that they don't want to tell you. And in many cases, it's a hit-and-miss proposition, and unfortunately, in later years, it becomes such a long process. You rarely get to, I mean, 5 years later, I'll get a reply to something. I may not even remember what it was, so I don't do them myself, but I think it would be worth doing.
I came up with zero on mine, but I want to say something about the records. It was partly the work of what Chris had done, his friends Dale and Jim, in the Computer UFO Network, in preserving the past FOIA requests and case information, including the legal documents. That was a great resource for me, and that's available online, including one of the key pieces of evidence in the case, the interview that the witnesses had at Bergstrom Air Force Base in 1981, August 17th, 1981. And it was it's very interesting because some of the information had begun to feed back. I think as the witnesses were questioned and the investigators processed the information, I think some of the information they accepted and may have begun to say more than they actually saw. And certainly it's my feeling that the witnesses at times described how they felt over what was actually happening to them. You know, your experience is colored by emotion. And I think that there's some of that in here. And that's not to say the witnesses weren't reliable. It's just to say that they're human.
We have Kurt Collins and Chris Lambright with Gene and KK in
the Paracast.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. If you'd like to listen to GCN programs on the go, I have great news. GCN has created a Droid and iPhone application, and it's free. Just as easy as going to GCNlive.com, click on the banner, and download. Before you know it, you'll be listening to your favorite hard-hitting GCN shows, live or on demand, right on your Droid or iPhone, 24/7 and on the go. So download the Droid and iPhone app free by clicking on the banner at GCNlive.com. Thanks again for listening to GCNlive.com. Again, that's GCNlive.com.
We the people grow cotton, weave fabric, engrave ink, embed strips and fibers to protect from counterfeit and carting to a private bank, having it lent back at interest, forcing taxes to service debt. This capitalism, or was Jefferson correct when stating a central bank issuing the public currency is a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army? Ted Anderson, I'm placing a free silver dollar in a book that explains our monetary system. Call for your copy, 800-686-2237. It's time to understand the system. Call 800-686-2237. That's 800-686-2237.
Springtime is sale time at Herbal Healer Academy. Current customers know this is the time to save big and stock up at HerbalHealer.com. New customers, welcome to the web's best place to save on vitamins, minerals, and more. Right now, Herbal Healer's spring specials include our 500 parts per million colloidal silver, all sizes on sale. CoQ10 with Hawthorn, Colon Enhancer, Sea Cucumber, Super Fam and Super Male Plex, plus Glucosamine Chondroitin, our best-selling liquid CalMag Vitamin D, and our colloidal minerals, all on sale for spring at HerbalHealer.com. And Herbal Healer also offers certificate correspondence courses in natural medicine. Enjoy same-day shipping and free online newsletter. Log on to our nation's leader in supplying quality natural medicine and education since 1988. Herbal Healer Academy at HerbalHealer.com.